nice to see you all here. You know, we're talking about that book that was handed out, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and in my estimation is the finest book that's ever come out of that New York office since the original AA book. Because for the first time in their history, they have told the truth about how AA started. And it's in that book. And if you run through that book and read it carefully, if you're interested in the history of this fellowship, you'll be really enlightened. Because it's a very interesting history to this movement, and very few people know anything about it. I don't suppose everyone cares a whole lot, but I would say that if you're in a fellowship, which means a matter of whether you're living or existing, it might be a good idea to find out all you can about it and who's running the show and what have you. And this book tells a lot about people whom you've never heard of. Of course, you'll find yours truly running all through that book, and my first wife, Dorothy, who threw me out sober, and she threw me out drunk, both ways. She first threw me out drunk, and I come back and got sober, and she threw me out that way. However, she and her family were good at throwing things. Well, anyway, you know, some very peculiar things happen in this fellowship, very peculiar, and there's never a dull moment. When I was married to Dorothy many, many years ago, this was many years ago, way back in 1926, it's Prohibition days, and if any of you read my story in the big book, The Home Brewmeister, you might recall that she became pregnant and the doctor thought it would be a good idea for her to drink some porter ale. Of course, the Prohibition days were in vogue at that time, and so being a dutiful husband, I bought a 6-gallon crock and a dozen bottles, and I made some porter ale for this ailing wife. And I was a good husband, so I also drank it for her. So I did the whole job. And the next thing you know, why, I was getting 2 10-gallon crocks to add to the 6, and several dozen big bottles, and I was really going into this drinking beer in quite a pace. You know, the way we start out sometimes, it's very innocent, the way we start out drinking. I'm a kind of a freak. When I was a young fella, I never drank. I went around with some fellas who did, but I thought they were dippy, because we used to go to dances. I was a dance hall chic in those days. I was always out chasing the girls to the dance halls. I never caught too many, but I chased a lot of them. And they would get drunk and get sick and all over the place, and I couldn't see where this is any fun. So I thought it was foolish, and so I never drank when I was a kid, till 3 times, and that's all. But I got in trouble each time I drank. I'm not going to go into any drunkologue, but needless to say, I went from beer to whatever could be drank. And at the end of my drinking career, I was paying 7 cents a pint for my booze, and I bought it in a wallpaper store. So nobody quits drinking because they run out of money. You just change your quality of drinking, not your quantity. And I stayed drunk all the time. I was a chronic drinker. There are two kinds of drinkers, two kinds of rummies. There's a chronic and there is the periodic. The periodics, Grace is a periodic, I'm a chronic, but the periodics are the people that ought to be barred from the universe because they give us a bad name. They are the people who get a good job, get a nice wife, or a nice family, get a nice home, a couple of automobiles, some money in the bank, and have a nice thing going, belong to a club or two, and they're rather upstanding people in the community. And all of a sudden, and for no apparent reason, they get drunk. And I mean, they make a fetish of it. When they get drunk, away goes the wife and the family and the house and the furniture and the cars and the bank account, the job and the whole bit. Well, what happens? These monkeys, after a while, they get another job. And this is what always kills me. They generally get a better job than they had in the first place. You get another wife, another house, another load of furniture, two more cars, two more clubs, and on they go, and away they go. And then pretty soon the whole thing happens all over again. Now, no wonder people look down on alcoholics. There has to be something wrong. Now, with me, that doesn't happen. I am dependable. I am a chronic. I'm always drunk, and I'm not surprising anybody. So they accept me as I am. I'm acceptable, and I walk in different society. After a while, I'm lying around in different society. My social life progressed downward till I became a bum. And that's how I got here in this fellowship. I got here by a series of miracles, and I can't find any other explanation for it, because I had nothing to do with it at all. As I mentioned before, I was married to a girl who was a member of a very clannish family. This family of hers invented togetherness, and they were always together in my house. And this family used to have family conferences to which I was never invited, for the simple reason I was usually the subject under discussion. And the discussions ran along the lines of whether they're going to let me back in again or throw me out again in my own home. Well, this went on a long time, and I want to tell you about the miracle. Finally, they got a bright idea. None of them at that time were alcoholics. They were earth people. They were civilians. And they think. They're different than rummies. Rummies don't think. We emote. We never do anything. We never stop to think about anything. We just do something. But people, other people, think. And they got to one of these conferences going one time and got real good thinking going on. And they decided that I should go to work for her brother. And her brother had a truck, a big tractor trailer deal, and he hauled merchandise between Cleveland and New York and back. And they got the idea that I should go to work with him, learn to drive this truck, and that would bring two items to bear. First of all, I could earn a living. I'd been between jobs for a long time then. And this would give me a suitable income, and at the same time, he could ride herd on me to see that I didn't get drunk. Now, that's good thinking. But when you get thinking around an alcoholic, you run up the wrong alleys. Because I had to do this or try it, so I started out on this trip with him. But unfortunately, I got away from him the second night out. He drove all night long and all the next day, and we got into Albany, New York. I'll never forget this. And he had to rest. Finally, so we pulled the rig over to the curb and said he's going to take a nap for a couple hours. I said, good. We are in Albany, New York, the capital of New York State. I always wanted to see these Capitol buildings. And away I went. Now, an alcoholic always has an ace in a hole. And if he doesn't have one, he makes one. I had a dollar and some change on my person that he did not know I had. And when I got out of there, of course, I headed for the first watering hole I could find. And one look at this told me that this was not the place for me with $1.20. So I went out of there and went down a few blocks and found a place that is more suitable to a man of my estate, a real dump. And when I got in there, immediately I found an angel. I rather fancy he was a fairy, but I'll call him an angel. Because he started buying me drinks and throwing them in me as fast as I could take them. Well, after a while, things were getting a little sticky with this Berg. I thought I'd better break my connection. And I went in the bathroom, locked the door, and went out the window and started back for the truck. Well, I guess all these drinks, I hadn't had a drink for 2 days then, which was a record for me. And on the way back, why, these things probably all hit me. And in my efforts to get up in my little nest up in the back of the seat there, where that little window is in the cab, I stepped on this poor boy's face. And of course, he came alive with a start, and church was out. And we had a very, very uncomfortable trip into New York City. Very, very embarrassing, very distant relationship. And finally, we got to New York City. He threw me out on the waterfront. He told me, this is the end of the line. Don't ever come back. You're done. So there it is, the beginning of winter. I'm telling you, I don't know why it is that everything happens to me in the wintertime. It's the beginning of winter. I don't have any overcoat. My clothes are pretty ragged because I'd sold all my good clothes for booze. And there I am in New York City. And there's probably 8 million people around that greater New York, and I know only one family in New York City, and that's another sister of his, and she's one of the committee. So she is hostile. But she's my only chance. So I made my way out to Yonkers. I knew where she lived because I was there on my honeymoon originally. So I say these people did everything together. And I remember Virginia lived up on a hill. But I didn't go up on that hill. I went down a hill, and I got into the Italian section down there. And in those days, all Italians had wine. A lot of them made it. Some of them sold it. A lot of them drank it, and some of them shared it with their friends. So I went down there and made friends. And time I got up to Virginia's house, I was a real mess. I can't remember too much about that trip to her home, but it all fits into this miracle that I'm talking about. I was rolling around on the floor with her two little baby girls. They were just little kids, 2 or 3 years old. And I'm drunk, and I'm dirty, and I stink. And Virginia took a dim view of this performance. She put me in her car. These folks were always riding me somewhere. And she took me back to New York City where her brother had thrown me out, and she did likewise. And there I was, without any money, without any clothes, no place to go, don't know a soul. And I'm 600 miles from home, and I'm not welcome there anyway. So there I am, separated from humanity. Well, I stayed in New York a long time. And I can tell you, if you ever get in real trouble, go to New York City. That's a city that has more suckers per square mile than any place I have ever found. And they all think they're smart. Really. It's funny how I existed. I could spend the whole night telling you about it. And there's some funny stories about it. However, I'm not going into that. But here's what happened. A few days or so after I'd been out to Virginia's home, her doctor called on her. And I don't know if I infected the kids or what, but the doctor was also a family friend. And they were talking about drinking, which was in that era, the bootleg time, it was a favorite subject of conversation in society. So she related this story to this doctor about this brother-in-law of hers, who used to be such a nice guy, her favorite brother-in-law, and what a no-good drunken bum he is now. Complimentary. So this doctor says, you know, that's odd. He says, I have a brother-in-law who is a lush, and he met some strange cult of people down here at Calvary House in New York. And he don't drink anymore. He spends all his time chasing around New York trying to fix drunks. He brings them home. He don't have much luck with their drunks. They smash up his furniture and stuff like that. But he keeps at it, and he don't drink anymore because he's chasing these drunks all the time. Keeps them busy. And he says, likewise, there's a Dr. Robert Smith in Akron, Ohio, who is, if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, he can go down and see this Dr. Smith, and he spends all of his time fixing drunks, and he's a drunk himself. So he said, so he told all this news to Virginia. So Virginia relayed this news to Dorothy about this doctor in Akron, but Dorothy never expected to see me again, but you know, a bad penny will always come back, and we do get that homing instinct. So one day comes along, this was winter again. This wasn't the same winter, however, but it was winter again. And I decided to go back to Cleveland. And I could tell you how I existed in New York. It would take too long. So some trucker took me to Erie, and another one took me into the outskirts of Cleveland where I lived. And I headed up to the porch to get in my home. And Dorothy had not taken down the screens or anything, and it was the middle of winter, and I lived in a snow belt out there. It was horrible. And she had the screen door hooked, I banged on the door and she came to the door, but she did not unhook that screen door. And I hadn't seen her in a long time. You'd think this would be a great homecoming, you know. But no, I was trying to get in. I was using all my wiles and my everything I knew how to do it, but she was relentless. No go. Finally, though, Virginia had written her about this doctor in Akron. And Dorothy told me about him, asked me if I'd like to go down and meet him. Well, I know that I'm not getting in the house. And what can I lose? I can transact my business in Akron as well as I can in Cleveland. So, okay. So she drives me down. She puts me in her car. Oh, you're getting a ride. And she took me down to the bus depot, gave me Doc Smith's name and address, and bought me a one-way ticket to Akron and got rid of me. And that's where I went. That's how I met my sponsor. Now, the miracle of this whole thing is this doctor in New York City is Dr. Herbert Strong, who happens to be Bill Wilson's brother-in-law. And the doctor he's talking about in Akron was Dr. Robert Smith, Dr. Bob, whom you're going to read about in this book. He was my sponsor. Now, I don't know either one of those fellows. I'm 600 miles from home. I never heard of them. And here all this stuff comes together. I'm inadvertently running into the two people who are credited with starting this whole ball of wax. So I call it a miracle. I don't know what you call it. So that's how I got there. Doc put me in the hospital, and these men who had preceded me, this was not AA yet. AA had not been formed yet. Bill Wilson attended Oxford group meetings at Calvary House under Dr. Shoemaker in New York, and Dr. Bob was attending Oxford group meetings in Akron at the home of T. Henry and Clarissa Williams. So they were Oxford groupers. Doc Smith had been attending Oxford group meetings 2.5 years before he ever heard of Bill Wilson, but he didn't stay sober. He only got drunk once after he met Bill. So he was sober and he had access to this city hospital, pardon me. He was on the staff there and he would put drunks in that hospital to dry them out. Not for alcoholism, hospitals wouldn't take you in for alcoholism in those days, but I had acute gastritis, that's what he had on my, I suppose I had it, I might as well put that as something else. So he put anybody in under some pretext. We got in anyway. And while in that hospital, the men who preceded me, I think if I remember correctly, there was about 14 of them that were dry a little while in Akron, in the Oxford group. The Oxford group was not a group set up for alcoholics, it was for sinners. Sinners, they had a book out, one of their books was named for Sinners Only. And if you were a sinner and wanted to overcome your sins, well, you would join the Oxford group and accept their program. They had a six-step program, and you accept this program and go out and try to help other people get over their sins. You'd get well and you'd have a good society you could move around in. Frank Buckman started the Oxford group years ago. He was a little old preacher from down in Pennsylvania, and he landed over in Oxford, England at the college. And he got a hold of some of these college students and sold them on the idea of a better way to live by these six steps, the six-step program, and the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. And this Oxford movement spread all over the world and became a very powerful movement. They had a lot of very influential people in it. And but it was not put together for alcoholics. But alcoholics will worm in any place. And they certainly did. Some of them wormed into the Oxford group in New York. A few of them, not too many, were successful there. But more of them were successful down in the Akron outfit. So we were a minority. The alcoholics were a minority. Most of those people were earth people or civilians. And they talked a different language than we did. And when I went into that meeting, those first meetings, the first few weeks or months, I didn't know what was going on, tell you the truth. But I know these people were all very loving, and they were all hugging each other, and everybody, it looked like a family reunion and everything every time you go to a meeting. And I must say they were very wonderful to me, especially some of the ladies. These are non-alcoholic ladies. I'll never pay my debts to people like Annie Smith and Henrietta Dotson and Henrietta Seiberling especially for all the time and the effort and the love they showed me, a bum. Because I walked into that house that night, T. Henry was a millionaire. He had a patent on something that went into every tire that was made in Akron. He got a rake off on it, so he wasn't hurting for dough. And so I walked into this beautiful home, and I felt really out of place. I didn't even have an overcoat, and this was in February, and I had mission clothes on, and I didn't smell too hot. I just come out of that hospital, and all those people, I walked in that beautiful place with the oriental rugs and the grand piano over here, paintings on the wall, and some of this fancy little porcelain bric-a-brac sitting around, which I took special notice of. I took an inventory. And those people, I just couldn't get over it, and the place was full of ladies. And I hadn't been around feminine company for a long time. I don't know, they weren't acceptable or something to me, I don't know. I just wasn't around them. And so this was something new. And it was a terrific experience. Well, one thing that Doc did, the biggest shock I got, when I looked across the room, I saw my wife Dorothy sitting over there, who had barred me from home. So Doc apparently had called her and sold her on the idea of coming down to that meeting and giving me another chance. And she did. God bless her. And I stayed home for over a year, and it gave me a chance to get on my feet, and then she threw me out sober. And, well, it's a long story. But let me tell you something, kids. And I say this to show you what can happen to people. You never want to condemn anybody. You don't ever want to hold resentments about these things. I lived to see the day that Dorothy, my wife, who was not an alcoholic when I was with her, she became an alcoholic over in the West Coast after marrying three or four other turkeys. And she wound up in AA out there and was very instrumental in the building of that big club they have there, that one of the largest clubs. Those two little kids that I was rolling around on the floor with, they are both in AA in San Diego, Florida, or San Diego, California. Virginia and her husband both wound up into AA. He's dead now, but she's still alive. Now you figure that one out. Those are the people that kicked the devil out of me, and they all wound up in this same pot that I was in. And they probably suffered worse than I did. But this is a miraculous situation. I think every one of us is a miracle that we get here. You know, we talk about the history of AA. AA has changed an awful lot over the years. The principles have not changed, but the people who are in charge of things are fouling this AA up for us real good. Believe me. This doesn't look like the AA that started out in many places that I go. And it's unfortunate. I don't say that everything in the good old days was good, because all those good old days weren't so good either. But I'll tell you one thing. We had a record of success with people that they can't approach today. And there are reasons for it. And I think one of the main reasons, when I came to this fellowship, it was not AA. I'm the guy that broke the alcoholics out of the Oxford group and started the first AA group. I get a lot of criticism from people for saying that, but they don't understand or they don't want to understand or they won't listen. They won't ask me about it. They just say, that guy says he started AA, and that's it. And they say, he didn't do it at all. He's a liar. Well, they know nothing about it, but I did start the first group. Why? I'll tell you a little thing about this. I attended these Oxford group meetings in Akron, and the Oxford group was a Protestant evangelical movement, and it had no Catholics in it for the simple reason that a Catholic would not be permitted by his church to attend such an affair. So they didn't have any. Doc told me when I left Akron that night, that first night after out of the hospital, my first meeting, he said, "You go back to Cleveland and spend the rest of your life fixing rummies as an avocation." And I went back to Cleveland and endeavored to follow out his orders. With all my ignorance and everything else, I'm trying to fix rummies and I don't know anything more about or where to start. So there was no shortage of rummies, believe me. This was back in 1938. And I would walk right up the street, meet a rummy on the street, and I'd say to him, "You ought to quit drinking. You ought to be like me." That's a great approach, believe me. And you might realize I did get some resistance. And some of this resistance, I might say, was physical. So it was some deal. But I had a lot of, gall, a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of ignorance, and I went out and spread it around. I called on all the social workers, a lot of doctors, a lot of judges, a lot of police, and went to the missions. I went every place that had anything to do with rummies. And I even talked to a lot of these service clubs, like the Rotary Clubs and the Lions Clubs and those people. They'll take anybody for a speaker. They need speakers. So it was no trick getting in there. And then one would send me to the next one. Well, anyway, for 7 long months, get this, 7 months, I knocked my bloody brains out attacking rummies of various kinds without success. So I finally got my first one. Finally, it took me 7 months after talking to hundreds and hundreds of assorted rummies, dipsomaniacs, drunks, or what have you. And I finally got this guy, and I'll never forget him if I live to be 2,000 years old, because I never saw a man in his condition in my life before or since. Back in those days, some of you folks that have gray hair can remember that depression back there in the 30s, where a lot of people lost their homes and there were a lot of empty houses sitting around and a lot of men just walking, wandering around, these rummies, and they would form bottle gangs and they'd go in any place where they could get out of the weather. So they would take and get into one of these vacant houses. There'd be 15, 20 of them going to a house or more. And after they tore all the woodwork out and burned it so they didn't freeze, then they'd move to another house. And this just went on. So I wandered into one of those houses one day, and there's a whole bunch of these drunks lying around. Some of them are up and some of them are down. And I'd get right down to those guys and ask them if they wanted to quit drinking. Well, I was getting plenty of abuse. I'll never forget this. I walked into a back room there, which used to be a kitchen. And here's this big man lying on the floor on his back, and he can't move a muscle. His name was Bill Hess. And he'd been an auditor for Sherwin-Williams Paint Company in Cleveland some years before. And he'd been on the bum for several years, and his family lived there in Cleveland. He hadn't seen his family or his 4 kids or anything for a long, long time. Kids are growing up on him already. And he's lying on the floor there, and he can't... I never saw a person in this shape. Maybe you have. You're in that business. This guy couldn't move a muscle, but he knew everything I was saying to him. He could speak. He couldn't move. He was... Well, you talk about being stiff drunk. He was it. And I got down there on the floor with him and asked him if he'd like to quit drinking. And he was all for it. And he's the first guy that ever gave me any encouragement. Well, it's a long story how this happened. Oh, I have to tell you this. Just to show you what we did, what lengths we went to get people. Remember, I had never sold this idea to anybody yet. So I got down there and I asked him an awful silly question. If he could get a hold of $50, I could put him in a hospital for a week for $50 then. I might as well ask him for $50 million, because just as close, he didn't have a quarter. He didn't have a dime. But he says, "My mother lives out in Madison, Ohio, which was 55 miles east of Cleveland, and she's on a farm out there, and if you tell her that you can get me fixed, she can get the $50 because she's got money out there. See, the banks were closed then, and people who had any money either had little mounds out in the backyard where they buried it in tin cans, or they had it in sugar bowls, or behind the mantel clock or someplace, or under the rug or in the mattress. So he told me that his mother had money. Well, that's all I needed to know. So I get in my jalopy and I head for Madison, 55 miles away. And I got out there and it's a farm and she lived way back on a lane. The lane looked a little muddy and I was afraid of chance driving back there, so I decided to walk back there, which I did. I parked the car on the road and walked back. And all of a sudden, a fearsome thought hit me. I heard guns going off everywhere. In fact, it sounded like the Battle of the Marne. And it came to me that this is the first day of hunting season, and all these idiots are running around there. They're probably pals of his and probably all drunks, and they're running around shooting at everything that moves. And I'm out in the middle of this lane by this time, so I stood there praying. What should I do? Should I keep on going or turn around and leave the whole thing go to smash? But my anxiety to get my first baby overcame everything. I went up to the house and I pounded on the door, and a little weazened old lady came to the door. It was his mother. And Bill forgot to tell me when this guy's name was Bill Hess. He was of Polish extraction. And he forgot to tell me that his mother was Polish and did not speak English. And I'm 55 miles out in the country in this farm, and here I am trying to talk this old gal out of $50. Well, she don't know from what I'm talking. I only know two words in Polish. I know Jaksimash and Dubche. You can just Jaksimash and Dubche so long you run out of conversation. So there was some little kid there, must have been a grandkid, a grandchild, about 7 or 8 years old. And would you believe it, through that kid as an interpreter, I talked that old lady out of that $50. When I told her that I had her boy in tow, she hadn't heard from this boy for several years. She nearly went through the roof. She just went wild. She would give me $1 million if she had it to get that boy. So she went back in the bedroom and cut a lump out of the mattress and brought me 50 of these great big bills. Remember those great big bills they used to have? She brought me that money out in cash. And man, I went down that lane, and away I'd gone. If they were shooting at me, they couldn't hit me. So I got in my car and went back, and Bill's still lying in the same spot. He hadn't moved yet. And I got some of those other jugheads together to help pick him up. And throw him in the back of my car, and I called Doc and I told him I'm coming with a new baby. That was my first triumph. I was walking this high off the ground. I had succeeded. I had finally sponsored someone. I never felt I'd ever be a member of this fellowship till I'd successfully sponsored someone. That seemed to be the criterion. And here I had succeeded. Now I am a legitimate Indian. I'd won my feather, see? Now I know why it took me 7 months. Looking back, it took me 7 months to sell my first baby. And it was a sales job. Don't let anybody tell you anything about this crap about this being a program of attraction. This is not attraction. This is a promotion. And you're promoting the greatest thing in the world. I can't understand how anyone would have been attracted to me walking around the streets of Cleveland back there in 1938. I had to go out and sell somebody something. So all these crazy things that people dream up, these Madison Avenue wonders, you want to examine them before you accept them too well. Well, anyway, I had Bill, and this did something for me. Immediately after Bill Hess's hospitalization, bing, 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 I got a whole bunch of guys coming in. Had about a dozen of them, right bingo, soon after that, and taking them down to Akron to these meetings at the Oxford Group. Now here's how AA started. Seven of those first men, including Bill Hess. Bill was of Polish extraction and had been of Catholic persuasion. And Catholics did not belong to the Oxford Group, as I mentioned before, because their church would not permit that. And here we had an Irish invasion then. A whole bunch of Irishmen descended upon me. I'd been chasing them. And they all fell in at one time, practically. So they all come to me. All of a sudden, they become good Catholics. And they probably hadn't been in church in 16 years, most of them. But that's the way people do. And so they come and told me they couldn't go to these Oxford group meetings because it was a Protestant evangelical outfit and they read out of the King James Version of the Bible and they had open confession and all this kind of... They gave me all the reasons. Well, what to do? The only thing I know to do is go down and talk to my sponsor. And I went down to see Doc about it and told him my problem. He says, well, we're not keeping the Catholics out. He says, no, we're not keeping them out. The church keeps them out. It's all the same thing. They can't come. He says, well, that's their tough luck. I says, no, Doc, it don't have to be their tough luck. We don't need all this falderall of the Oxford movement now. Now, remember, I'm 15 months sober. I'm telling my sponsor all about it already. I don't know why I waited so long. They don't wait that long today. So, I said, we have a program here. Of 12 steps. We were just had written the book in the fall of 38 and it came out in February 39, and this is May of 39 that I'm talking to Doc. The book had been in print 3 months. I says, we have a 12-step program. That, along with the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, and purity and love, anyone can live with that program, whether he has religion, organized religion or not, whether he be a Catholic or whatever he might be. That isn't going to hurt anybody. But they can't stand the dogma and the creed and so forth that some of these things that are called for in the Oxford group. He says, well, you can't do that. I said, what? Can't do what? He said, you can't break this thing up. I said, I'm not trying to break anything up. I'm just trying to open it up so everybody can get in. Oh, we had a riot. And he got mad at me. I got mad at him. And I said, we're going to do something. He says, like what? I said, you'll see. So here I had another Irishman in the hospital, and Al Goldrick, you'll see his story in one of the later editions of the AA book, The Man Who Thought He Could Drink Like a Gentleman. You'll read that, you'll see my name in that one. I chased that guy all winter long. I went out to see his wife. I finally got him in the hospital in Akron, and he's all fogged up. I didn't go down to see him about it. I went out to see his wife about using his house for a meeting place. He had a big home. He was losing it. And he's also getting kicked out of his law firm. He was a patent lawyer. But coming into the fellowship, he saved it all. So I went out and talked to Grace Goldrick about using her house, and she was delighted with the idea. So here's how AA started, kids. Remember this. I went down and made the announcement the next meeting of the Oxford group in Akron that this is the last time the Cleveland contingent will be down here as a group. We are going to open our own meeting in Cleveland, Ohio, and I made the mistake of giving them the address. I should not have done this. 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights, next Thursday night. And I said this is what killed them. I says, this is not going to be known as an Oxford group. It's going to be called Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book, and only alcoholics and their families are welcome, nobody else. Well, you can imagine what happened. All those people had been so good to us, and that's where we were born and given our chance, and I'm cutting all those people out, the non-alcoholics. Boy, oh boy, the roof came off the house. But if I thought that was a riot, they just got all over me. You should have seen next Thursday night up at 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. That thing in Akron is a picnic. They all descended upon us up there on our meeting, and they tried to break our meeting up, and one guy was going to whip me, old Bill Jones. He was going to work me over, and I'm sure this was all done in pure Christian love. But anyway, we stood our ground, and that's how AA started. That was the first group ever organized as Alcoholics Anonymous. About that time, the Calvary House people in New York threw the drunks out. Because they were having so much trouble with them, they threw them out of the meetings there. And so that's when Bill had to go take his flock of whatever he had left and take them home and start working on them at his home. But they didn't have any AA going there for a long time. And Akron never broke out of the Oxford group till about a year after we started in Cleveland. So eventually they had to do it. So that is a history of how it started. Now, why did we have such a success with drunks in those days? Let me tell you something. I get a lot of flack yet today. I always have for the last 45 years for getting publicity for AA. They all think I'm getting it for Clarence Snyder, but it's not me. It's what people have to know about this, and there's a way of putting things out. And I don't go by any rules and regulations that anybody in New York or any place else lays down. I do what I feel is the right thing to do, and if I think my prayers are answered accordingly, I will do what I'm supposed to do, and it usually comes out all right. So we got going there in Cleveland, and we had a system of working. First of all, I made a survey. All the publicity that came in, that Cleveland Plain Dealer and all these other things that came along, hundreds and hundreds of inquiries from all over, I kept record of these. They all came through me, and I handed them out to these men and had them chase them down. And 2.5 years after the first 250 people came into AA in Cleveland, 2.5 years later, I made a check on these people. And it's a pretty accurate check. And 93% of them never had a drink. Now figure this one out. So we were doing something right. Now what were we doing right? What was the difference? Let me tell you what I see the difference on AA today and AA when we thought we were doing things as right as they could be done. I grant you that years go by, we're supposed to learn things. And we have grown tremendously in numbers in this fellowship, but I doubt very much how percentage wise how many people get any real benefits out of this fellowship. Some of them stay dry, some of them keep getting drunk and falling off, and they get on the pills and they get in something else. But here's why, in my estimation, why we had this kind of success with people. First of all, nobody could walk into one of our AA meetings. You had to be brought there. Someone, a sponsor, had to bring you. And before you ever came to one of our meetings, you had read the book, and a number of AA people had talked to you, and if you had a wife or a spouse, the spouse got a good education also, and that spouse came along to the meetings. There was no such thing as Al-Anon. It was a family illness, the whole family's sick, the family got well together. This is one of the things that people are overlooking today. So we never advertised that AA meets at 1234 Main Street at 8 o'clock, everybody welcome. That's ridiculous. They talk about anonymity today, and they let any dingbat who wants to walk right into the meeting and look the crowd over, you know. We never allowed such a thing. If someone walked into one of our meetings by some hook or crook or accident, somebody in the group met him and found out if he belonged there. If he was a member of another group, he's welcome. But if he's some bird that just wandered in off the street, he didn't stay at any meeting. They took him home. And they indoctrinated him into AA before he ever had the privilege of attending meetings. Now that sounds a little harsh, don't it? But I'm not interested in what's harsh. I'm interested in results. And we had those results. Now, I have seen something in AA today, only the last years, we get around this country a good deal, Grace and I do. We're invited here, there, and everywhere to attend different meetings and retreats and conventions and what have you, all these big shindigs they have. And we know people everywhere, all over this world practically. And I see what's going on. And I notice this. I go to meetings. I traveled for a good many years, and it gave me a good chance to visit a lot of groups, just dropped in on groups when I was traveling, because I had time to do that in my travels around the country here. And I see this. One of the things that shatters me, we no longer have groups in most places. We have meetings. And there's a vast difference between a group and a meeting. They have to close the doors at a certain hour. At a noon meeting, if you please. And the damn thing sits there empty and they're paying $500 a month rent for the place and nobody's in it. When those meetings are over, boy, after an hour, they're gone. 10 minutes after one, the place is deserted. What kind of fellowship is that? I say this is all wrong. I think that we ought to get acquainted with one another, stay together, and share with one another, and extend some love to one another. I try to talk to some of these people, boy. Well, I may not have anything to say, but at least I'm willing to offer a little fellowship with them. This is something that bothers me a whole lot, that we ought to start taking stock of. You're going to hear a lot about things in this weekend here that you don't hear in AA meetings, I'll tell you that. And I'm certainly glad for that. Now, we had a when we went to meetings back in those older days, this was a night out. It was not just running to a meeting for an hour and blowing. It was an evening out. I had to go 75-mile round trip to go to my meetings when I went to Akron, Ohio. And I get down there early. The meetings went on for hours, really. And after the meetings, how they're chewing the fat stuff, then someone was to go out and close up an ice cream parlor afterward. This is what we did. We were together all the time. They were only friends we had. Now, I understand and I realize that times are different today. People have money, and people are better situated financially and all that sort of thing. But they're no better situated morally and spiritually. And unless we start checking up on ourselves, we're going to come to an awful fall. I see this happening. It's too bad. Sponsorship, people don't understand what sponsorship is. I've heard this and you heard it. Some new person will come in a meeting and he's wandering around and he's poking around in the smoke and somebody says, get yourself a sponsor. What does that dunderhead know about getting a sponsor? If he picks anybody, he'd pick another slob like himself. What he needs is somebody who can teach him something. And somebody should sponsor him. They should pick him. He shouldn't pick anybody. He has no right to pick anybody. They come in here and tell you all about running your AA in about 2 weeks. Sure. Let's start checking on some of these things in our group and see what's going on here. Now, as I said before, everything in the old days wasn't so great. But we had success. And that's the bottom line. People getting well and having a great fellowship. We knew one another. We knew where everybody was. We stuck our nose in everybody's business. Now they won't even tell you who they are. This is absolutely asinine, any way you boil it. Let me tell you something about some of the first days of AA. When those plain dealer articles came out in the fall of 39, and those inquiries start coming in, oh, did they come in. We were all busy, busy, busy. And I get all those inquiries and give every man a handful of them on Monday morning and tell him to go out and chase them down and report to me Wednesday what he did with them, just like a sales manager does. And they did it. And they covered these. I stayed up most of the night writing correspondence courses in AA to guys out here in Nebraska somewhere in that scribbling of mine. I've got very little sleep there for months when that thing came in. People got well. Groups started around the country out of that. I remember that three people were coming in so fast in Cleveland back there in early 39 that we just couldn't handle them on a one-on-one basis anymore. They were coming too fast. So I figured there had to be some way we could teach this in classes. So I'm trying to figure out where I can find a place where we can get these guys all together in a group and talk to them in a group. And finally, as the good Lord always takes care of a need. If you have a need and you ask him to help you, he'll do it. So I'm praying for some place we can find for this. So I go out one day, I had a handful of these inquiries too, and I'll never forget this one. The guy's name was Walter Beilstein. I have this name, I don't know Walter Beilstein from a load of hay. But he lives down in a declining neighborhood. It used to be a millionaire's neighborhood, where all those big 22-room houses are with carriage houses in the back. But most of those people who were well-fixed had moved out in the Heights, and this neighborhood was declining, and they were mostly rooming houses and things like that. It had all these rooms. But in this case, I got out there, and it happens to be the Beilstein Funeral Home. This big home is transformed into a funeral home. So the big sign in front. So I charge up on the front porch, and a fella asked me my business, and I said, I want to see Walter Beilstein. He says, who? I says, Walter Beilstein. He says, oh, Walter, Walter. And I knew I was in the right place. He says, he isn't here. He lives upstairs in the carriage house in the back. You go back there, you'll find him back there. So I know right away there's something loose here. So I go back there and climb the stairs and pound on the door, and Walter appears. And Walter is a guy in his early 30s, and he stands in front of me, and he's wearing a beret. The boys in those days that wore berets were looked upon with some suspicion. And Walter is very affable, he's very polite, and he's very drunk. And he invites me in. And I go in this place, and holy smokes, I take one look at this thing, and I said, good, thank you, Lord, you have provided. This guy, as well as it developed, Walter was single. He had never had anything to do with girls. He didn't know anything about girls. They were not in his orbit at all. But he had a hobby, and his hobby was, he had two hobbies. He had a Great Dane dog there that weighed about 160 pounds who was playful and would charge at you and want you to catch him. And he had a stage there. This whole upstairs of this place, he had converted into a show. He put on amateur theatricals, and he bought a couple of hundred used picture show seats somewhere and had them stapled to the floor, and he had a great big stage up at one end. And his living quarters with his bathroom and kitchen and all that was at the other end. And I looked at that thing, and I've been praying for a meeting place to train people. And I said to Walter, Walter, you are a gift from heaven. He says, I am. I said, you bet you are. I said, Walter, you know, we're going to do something here that you're going to like. And I know he's a ham. And I says, how many of those seats you got out there? He says, I don't know, about 200. He says, you know what we're going to do, Walter? He says, what? He says, we're going to fill those seats every night. Well, that's all he wants to hear. He wants those seats filled. So we just took Walter's place over, and every night of the week, 100, 200 men would stream up behind the funeral home and up those stairs into Walter's place. And we just took Walter's place over. Well, Walter had never been very important, so I made Walter a captain. He was a captain in AA. Everybody called him Captain. He's Captain Walter. Well, he got very busy, and he forgot all about this drinking business all the time. So those men would come up there, and funny things happened up there. The neighbors started to wonder why all these men were streaming up there every night at just at dusk, going up in this place. There's something nefarious going on up there over that, behind the funeral home. So they send the police up one night. The cops come up, and I meet them at the bar. And I says, want to know what's going on? And they see these guys around. Of course, they recognize some of them. They've been picking them up and putting them in the jug and driving them down there and driving them back. And the cop asked me about what's going on here. And I says, we're fixing these drunks. They don't drink anymore. And he points out something. You mean that guy ain't going to drink anymore? And that guy ain't going to never drink anymore. Well, there's nothing wrong. They can't find anything wrong with that thing, so they leave. See? Well, a couple of nights later, a little old lady come charging up those stairs, and she has fire in her eyes. No kidding. She's a neighbor. And she wants to know what's going on in her neighborhood. The neighborhood's going to pot. So I go through the same thing with her. And she recognizes some of these dough heads because she's been sweeping them off her lawn in the mornings, you know. She says, "You mean that guy ain't going to drink? You mean he don't drink? He's not drunk?" "No. Never will be drunk anymore." And she looks at me and she says, "It's unbelieving." So finally she softens down and she knows that some of these guys are real bums. You know, she knows they recognize some of them. She says, "You know, I have a boy and he's on the bum somewhere. Can you fix him?" I said, "Sure, we can fix anybody but faith." I said, "Where is he?" She says, "He's in New York." "Oh, whereabouts in New York?" He says, "I don't know. He's in New York." "How long has he been there?" "3 years." "But we haven't heard from him." "Well," I says, "give me his name. We'll see what we can do about finding him." She says, who do you have? And do you have anybody in New York?" I said, "Yeah, we got guys in New York. Who do you have?" So I gave her Bill Wilson's name and address. This old lady didn't wait to write any letters. She's on the first Rattler going to New York the next morning to look for Bill Wilson and have him find her boy. So she gets in. Now listen to this for a miracle. She went to her daughter's house. She had a daughter in New York. And she didn't get in that house 10 minutes, she told me. But our phone rang and her boy called his sister in that house. And that's how they found him. And she got a hold of Bill and the gang in New York, and they put that guy in AA, and he was the first editor of our grapevine. And he lived sober for 30 years till he died just recently. He died down here in Florida. Talk about miracles. When I look back on some of this stuff, it's unbelievable. You know, people don't have this kind of fun anymore in AA. Really, we had excitement. Something going on all the time. And different things happened, the different kind of people we met. Walter Beilstein never had a drink after that, and lo and behold, he never worked a day in his life either. He was a remittance man. His family paid him to stay out of the funeral home. So, anyway, old Walter got real busy, AA and all over the place. He got too busy to drink. And he got going to these hospitals where we had these patients, and something happened to Walter. Walter met a nurse there, and something happened. Walter got an itch he couldn't scratch. And he see this girl, and something happened to old Walter. He was a thumping, see? And he couldn't get over this girl. And first thing you know, he's courting her. And the next thing you know, he's asking her to marry him. Well, Walter's big love up to this time was that Great Dane dog, 160-pound pup that he had up there. That was his whole life, really, outside of his hobby with his theatricals. But that is the only thing living that he had any real connection with. So this girl agreed to marry him on a condition. That dog was too much. He'd have to get rid of that dog. It's like having a horse run around the house. And Walter, this was a real tough deal for Walter. He had to come to a decision, the dog or the wife. And this bothered him. He really suffered over this. And finally he agreed to, and he had somebody take the dog, a friend of his out in the country somewhere, and they got married. And Walter's running around there and all over creation and in the newlywed and all this stuff. And finally, a few months later, I see Walter is slowing up. And I noticed this. I said, "Walter, something wrong with you. You're not the same as you were. Tell Papa about it. What is it?" "So I miss my dog." I says, "Well, I imagine you do. That's just tough." He says, "No, I miss my dog. I gotta have my dog." I said, "Well, you made a deal with Mary about it, and that's it. Maybe you might talk to her. Maybe she'll give you weekend privileges or something, visiting privileges."
I didn't think she would, but her hope springs eternal. So he talked to her, but there's no dice. So he comes to another impasse in his life. The dog or Mary again. This time he threw Mary out and got the dog back. So that was the end of that. Now there are so many odd creatures that we met. I could talk to you about some of these people all night. And the different things that happened in those days. How we started a Salvation Army group. And what a terrific thing that was. How the first women came into AA. I brought the first gal into AA. I got hell for that, too. No, Bill and Doc wanted nothing to do with females in AA. He was afraid they were going to corrupt the men. And some of them walking around then probably could. But they were nicks. And I got hell Columbia for that. But I had a lot of experiences with some of these gals. But I ought to tell you about this one. You got a little time? You going anyplace? There's a lot of people asked me to tell this story about this girl, Catherine. Catherine, I had been in contact with some social workers there, and there was a Miss Mooney, a social worker, and she was a big husky Irish babe, and she wore tailored clothes and flat-heeled shoes, men's shoes she wore. Looked like it anyway. And she was quite an active social worker, and she sent me several men to fix. So she and I were pretty chummy, so she called me one day and asked me if we fix women, if we fix girls. I said, of course, we fix anybody. She says, I have one for you. So boy, oh boy, I go down to meet Catherine at her office, at Mooney's office. And Catherine is about as skinny as a match. She'd have to stand up twice to throw a shadow. She was really thin. She never ate. She drank all the time. And Catherine was Irish, and she had an awful big mouth. And I mean a vile one, too. That girl could swear like nobody I ever knew. I think she made up words. I heard words from her I never heard before. And Catherine, she thought she'd like to quit drinking. Catherine was living with some Italian bootleggers down in a colored neighborhood. It wasn't declining, it had already declined. And that's where she was living with these people, and she never worked, but Catherine would do anything but anything for a drink. And she was always drunk, so she seemed to be succeeding in whatever she was following up. So anyway, she wanted to quit drinking. So I took her in hand. I thought I was getting along fine with her. And went on a little while, and she was staying sober, staying dry, not drinking. Mooney had gotten her out of there and putting her in a decent place to live. And boy, I lived in a cheap boarding house at that time. That's after Dorothy had thrown me out. And I used to sell automobiles. That's how I had my transportation. I was selling Fords and Mercurys in those days. I rode drunks around in these cars all the time. Well, anyway, I used to go to my boarding house about every noon just to get away from the store for a while. So one day I was home at noon. I walked down toward the drugstore for something, and here comes Catherine toward me, and she's so drunk she couldn't hit the sidewalk with her hat. So, I mean, she's really drunk. So I grab her. I say, Catherine, I says, we got to get off the street. You just got off out of the pokey. She'd been in Warrensville Workhouse so many times. That was her home away from home, really. She says, okay. So I start taking her home, and she all of a sudden got the idea she wanted something to eat. Well, I know that she isn't capable of eating anything, and I don't fancy the idea of taking her in any decent restaurant, so I were passing a Greek restaurant there, and I try to steer her into this place, and she gets on her muscle. She says, I won't eat in a dump like that. I am a lady, and I'm going to eat in a restaurant that has tablecloths. I want a real restaurant, that bum. Well, I made the greatest mistake I ever made in my life up to that time. There was a nice restaurant down on 79th and Euclid. It was a spaghetti house, and they had waiters with tuxedos, carpet on the floor, and nice tablecloths, and it was quiet. All the business and professional people in that area ate lunch there at noon, and it was a nice, quiet, respectable place till then. And as soon as I got Catherine in there, I knew I had made a mistake, because Catherine is loud, Catherine is boisterous, she is profane, she's dirty, and she stinks. And the maitre d' comes along, and she has some words with him, but he did take us to a table and sit us down, and he admonished her to be quiet. Immediately she had a resentment toward him, the head boss. Well, a waiter came around, and he took our order, and of all things, she ordered spaghetti. She has about as much chance of eating spaghetti as I have flying to the moon. But she ordered it, and she had a few words with that waiter about things, and something about his ancestors, too. And she's making some noise, and first thing you know, she's having some problem with some people at this table over here. Then she's having a problem with some table over here. And this thing is spreading all through the restaurant. It's getting to be something. And the head waiter comes back and tells her she'd have to be quiet or she'll have to leave. And she told him something or other, and he left. The waiter brought the food, the spaghetti, and she starts to work on the spaghetti, and she can't eat it. She's wearing it. It's all dripping down here. And she's having so much trouble with all the customers in there. The head waiter come back again, and he should not have done this. He made a bad... This was a real error in his part. Because she already didn't like him the first time she saw him. And this is a third trip. And he comes up and starts giving her some gas, and she did nothing but take that plate of spaghetti and frighten his kisser with it and roll down his dickie here. Well, it wasn't but a couple of minutes till the wagon was there. And Catherine and I are both in the wagon. Down we go to the central station. They put her in some other coupe, and they had me in one in the front here. And I'm in that coupe, and I'm rattling on this damn thing. I'm telling them I don't belong here, and I can explain. They agreed that nobody belongs here. But I didn't get in any place. But I finally got tired of rattling that cage. I wasn't getting any place. And finally, the shift changed. They got some different cops in there, and I started my exercises again. And this one cop had the tenacity to come over and talk to me and find out what's going on. And I tried to explain to him that if he called the prosecuting attorney, this fellow Brennan, he knew me and he would explain the whole thing. He says, "Oh, you know him?" I said, "Yeah, call him up." And he did. They wouldn't even let me call anybody. I don't know what I was in there for. But anyway, this guy, this prosecuting attorney, I thought he'd have a hemorrhage laughing that I should get myself in such a fix, see? So he got me out, but they kept Catherine, and she went out to the Warrensville again for a 30-day stretch. And I didn't see anything of Catherine for a long time, till, by God, if I don't go out toward that drugstore again one noon, and here she comes. And if anything, she was in worse shape than she was the other time, and she just got out of Warrensville. I says, "Catherine, you just got out of that pokey, you're going to be right back in. Let's go home." He says, "Okay." I says, "We don't eat today, Catherine." Okay. Well, she's in such a condition that I was afraid to cross Euclid Avenue with her because of traffic. And she was just limp. And so I walked her up to 82nd where there's a traffic light so I could cross in safety. And I'll never forget that corner because there's a Unitarian church on one side and there's a Jewish temple on the other. And I'm waiting for that light to change, and I'm holding on to her so she don't fall down. And she feels the call of nature. And this is high noon again, and the street is full of people, and she squats right there. I'm standing there holding her hand. This ought to make a good movie. Well, you ain't going to believe this. That damn wagon came again. And we're both in it. And down we go. And I start this stuff again. And I see it's useless with that crew. So I waited. The next crew came in, and I got out again. And I thought, oh, Brennan would die laughing when he heard this time. So they got me out. But here's what, I went to Mooney, between Mooney and the prosecuting attorney and the judge. I told him that girl's never going to get well unless she has a long, 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 long period of confinement somewhere under supervision. So we agreed that the thing to do is have her charged with a habitual and give her a year and a day. And that's what the judge did. And out she went to her favorite haunts for a year and a day, but she did not like this. But I knew someday I was going to go out and have to go out and see her, but I was afraid to. But finally she told the matron she wants to see me. Well, I was making $20 a week then. I paid $10 a week room and board, and I got two meals a day and one on Sunday, which means I had to buy extra meals and haircuts and other things and cigarettes or what have you, and the rest of the money that I had left over I squandered on women. As you might know, I was the last of the great spenders. Well, anyway, I went to the dime store and bought her some stink water and some cigarettes and some gumdrops or something, and off I went to Warrensville with my little bag of goodies. And boy, oh boy, was I glad when I got to see her. They had that wire cage in front. And boy, the place was blue when I went in there. She told me all about my ancestors in a very unique fashion. And she wants out of there. And I told her, no, you're not going out of here. You're going to stay here a year and a day. And then the balloon goes up again. Finally, I offered her my little token, and she accepted this. I went out to see that old gal every week, once or twice, for a whole year. They had to put her in the hospital out there and get her. It took her months to clean that girl up. They didn't have all those wonder drugs in those days. And they finally cleaned her up and got some meat on her bones, and she started looking like a human being. And when she came out of there, Mooney got her a new place to live, way out on the other side of town. I took her to a meeting and they threw her out. They wouldn't, the women, the wives of the alcoholics would not allow her in the house. We were meeting in a home. So she couldn't go to AA. I took her to a few picnics and things like that where she had no identity. But Mooney got her this job on a bathing beach first. She was a lifeguard. She could swim like a fish. When the season ended, Mooney got her a job in one of the hotels as a floor clerk. And she saved her money. That woman was the tightest woman I ever met in my life. She wouldn't spend a dime to see the original crucifixion. She saved every dime she could get. And finally, she went to school. She went to and she took a refresher course in shorthand typing and that. And she got a stenographer's job, still saving her money, got a secretarial job. She went into the real estate business and she became a wealthy woman. She never got married. Last I knew of her, she was living in Palm Beach, Florida. She never got married. I think she's still waiting for me. But there is a story of something that you wouldn't get without sticking with a prospect. So that's the ultimate in sponsorship. Put up with that stuff. I wouldn't want to do that every time. But I just point out, we never, if somebody we worked with, we had something to offer them. And if they were willing to go a little better than halfway with us, we'd go all out. And this individual one-on-one sponsorship, you can't beat it. I think one of the things we need in AA today, I've talked too long already, one of the things we need in AA today are, more than anything else, are teachers. We go to AA meeting and this guy says this and this one says that one, that gal says this, and everything is organized confusion. People don't know what to believe, they listen to this stuff, and they come and tell me all about it. Oh, what you say isn't true, I heard so-and-so and so-and-so say this and so-and-so said this in a meeting. You don't know what you're talking about. They tell me this. What we need is teachers, people who teach this program. We have a program that can't lose. You can't lose if you will accept it and apply it to your life. But that's the big if. You know one thing that people overlook today in AA, when people come to AA, there's a qualification in this fellowship for membership here, and it's totally ignored. Every meeting one goes to today, you hear them read, or you should hear, you don't hear it, but it is read, the fifth chapter, how it works, and nobody hears it. Very few do. It goes over their head like an airplane. And that how it works is the whole secret of this whole thing. And it says right at the beginning of that fifth chapter, it tells us what the qualification is. It says this: if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are now ready to take certain steps. Isn't that as plain as the nose on your face? People don't hear that. People don't demand that of people coming in. Anybody can walk in and there you are. They sit down, I'm a member. You don't know what they're a member of. Then there are demands put up on us in this 12-step program. I don't have the time to go into all that tonight. I'd like to. But there are certain things we have to admit. We're powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. We have to come to believe that God can change this. Then we ask Him to do it. Then we go ahead and we take a moral inventory, find out what's wrong with us, cause us to be in all this trouble. Then we ask God to remove these defects of character. People don't do this. We should do it with a sponsor. Then if we get down to the restitution, go out and make our apologies to people, that should be done. And people don't do that either. Then we're supposed to go out and carry this message. So I go to meetings today.